Welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Carolyn Waters, the head librarian, and at this time I would like to ask if you could please silence your cell phones or anything that might disrupt the presentation. Thank you very much. I hope that you've all been enjoying the beautifully refurbished furniture here in the members' room. It was a project long overdue, as many of you probably realize, and we did the work in pieces over the summer, and I'm now happy to report that all of the furniture is now back in the room where it belongs and better than ever. So I hope you're finding it very good and very comfortable and beautiful. And we are so very grateful to a number of our members who very generously funded this project. Now it is my pleasure to introduce Jack Kelly and his new book, Heaven's Ditch, God, Gold, and Murder on the Erie Canal. The Erie Canal opened in 1825, and the major part of its construction was overseen by then Governor DeWitt Clinton. And you know how we are always love to look for New York Society Library connections everywhere. So many of you may realize that before he was governor, DeWitt Clinton was a senator, a mayor of New York City, and not surprisingly, a member of the New York Society Library. So obviously you need to do a little research, and in our City Readers resource, we see that he's reading a wide variety of topics, including philosophy, sketches of England and Italy, Herodotus, Buffon's Natural History, Voltaire's Critical Essays, and of course, Boswell's Life of Johnson. Surely some of that reading prepared him to tangle with the Erie Canal, its spiritual and political upheavals along this psychic highway, as Jack Kelly calls the canal. Jack Kelly is also the author of Band of Giants, the amateur soldiers who won America's independence and gunpowder, alchemy, bombards, and pyrotechnics. I love that title. As well as contributions to American heritage and other essential history resources. Please join me in welcoming Jack Kelly.
Now, in 1805, he was facing bankruptcy. Water was indispensable for carrying heavy loads. Teams of horses straining to pull wooden wagons could not compete with boats gliding along streams or lakes. Every major city in the nation had access to a river, a coast, or both. A horse that could pull 2 tons along a smooth road could haul 50 tons down a canal. Yet Hawley's idea was laughable. 360 miles of tangled forest and dank swamp land, of hills and valleys, separated Lake Erie from the Hudson River. Hawley need only consider the Middlesex Canal in Massachusetts, 27 miles end to end, then the longest canal in America it had taken 9 years to build. The same rate of construction a canal across New York State would not be completed until the unimaginable year 1925, when everyone now living would be in their graves. To Hawley, geography represented both an obstacle and an intriguing promise. The Great Lakes, all but Lake Ontario, stretched halfway across the continent at the same elevation. The Hudson crept inland entirely at sea level. Link the two and you would join the middle of the continent with the coast. The long downhill run from Lake Erie, dropping a foot every mile across the state to Albany, would carry a placid waterway navigable in both directions. Visions are cheap. Flashes of clarity come to all. Translating a vision into reality is always the challenge. Hawley had little formal education and no training in canal design or construction. No one in North America knew much about the subject. Even the English expert who had designed the Middlesex Canal was often at a loss when calculating levels or constructing locks. Soon after the canal vision came to him, Hawley watched his business go bust. He fled the state to avoid debtor's prison. Hiding out near Pittsburgh, he concluded, all my private prospects in life were blighted. To pass the time, he wrote 2 essays for a local newspaper on the subject of his dreamed-of canal. Determined to avoid ridicule and to hide his status as a deadbeat, he adopted the identity Hercules. I will presume to suggest, he began, the connecting of the waters of Lake Erie and those of the Mohawk and Hudson Rivers by means of a canal. The fugitive's conscience soon got the better of him. He returned to the Finger Lakes settlement of Canandaigua to face the music, 20 months in debtor's prison. Broke and destitute, he became convinced that hitherto I have lived with no useful purpose. To restore his sense of self-worth, he decided to publish to the world my favorite fanciful project of an overland canal. Hawley's prison was a Canandaigua hotel room. Confinement did not prevent his imagination from roaming freely. He managed to get hold of books and maps and to bone up on canal technology. Hercules wrote a series of 14 essays published in the Genesee Messenger beginning in 1807. His choice of a route for the canal and his estimate of its cost were both remarkably prescient. While he was writing, he learned of another transportation breakthrough. In August 1807, the inventor Robert Fulton had sailed the first commercial steamboat up the Hudson River, covering the distance from New York City to Albany in 32 hours instead of the 4 days needed by wind-driven schooners. Fulton became an instant celebrity and would soon sign on as an important canal backer. All eyes were on the future. Hawley said that it would be a burlesque of civilization to continue navigating farm brooks in bark canoes. Instead, he envisioned settlers rushing along canals to populate the newly accessible interior. He foresaw barges hauling lumber, flour, and other products from the Great Lakes down to the Hudson. Of New York City, he accurately predicted that in a century, its island would be covered with the buildings and population of its city. Besotted with canals, he discussed waterways branching from his main Genesee Canal and similar projects in other states. He even dreamed of a marine canal that would slice through the Isthmus of Darien, anticipating by a century the Panama Canal. The reaction reaction to the publication of this cherished idea was blunt. One critic declared that Hawley's scheme lies in the province of fancy and may be treated as a vision. Another described it as the effusions of a maniac. President Thomas Jefferson judged the idea little short of madness. The future would render a different verdict. So that's the opening of the book. And I took a lot of pleasure in writing this book, in part because it had connections to my youth. I grew up near the Erie Canal, and I used to, in the summer afternoons, watch barges go through the locks up there. I would ride with my family through the village of Palmyra, which was right on the canal, and just outside that village, we passed a hill, Camorra, and someone would always say, "That's where he found the golden tablets." And I didn't know who they were talking about, and I didn't know what the golden tablets were all about, but for a kid, you know, to dig in your backyard and find an old spoon was a thrill, so the idea of finding gold was a great, great intriguing idea. And when we went through that town of Palmyra, there was an intersection where there was a church in every corner, and it's still there today. They claim it's the only one in the world that had four churches facing each other. And as I began to do the research for the book, I began to realize how the Erie Canal really did change America and play a substantial role in American history. And I also began to see how those churches were emblematic of a spiritual excitement that played a great role in shaping the American character in those early days of the American Republic. Jesse Hawley's idea, the idea for the canal had been floating around for a number of decades before Jesse Hawley really put it together in writing. But his series of essays crystallized this idea. And as Caroline mentioned, the man who picked up the idea and ran with it, became the great champion of the canal, was DeWitt Clinton, mayor of New York, had been a senator. What she didn't mention was he also challenged James Madison for the presidency in 1812 as a peace candidate. So when they began to take the idea seriously, the two questions that arose, and always the questions with any public works project is, who benefits and who pays? And the people from New York said, well, the whole country will benefit, so the federal government should pay for it. And that's sort of always the fallback position, to get federal money for your project. And so they sent DeWitt Clinton down to Washington. He had a lot of contacts down there, and he was able to convince Congress to pass a law providing money for the Erie Canal. They were actually going to tax the banks in order to get the money. It was kind of Bernie Sanders approach. But unfortunately, James Madison, 3 days before he left office, vetoed that bill. And he said that the federal government had no authority to spend money in that way and that it was unconstitutional. And the people from New York said, wait a minute now. Madison's from Virginia, and Virginia was a great competitor to New York for the inland trade, and maybe that was his motivation for vetoing the funding for the Erie Canal. But since Madison had largely written the Constitution, it was a little hard to argue with that. The choice was up to New York to either go it alone or not at all. And it was an enormous risk. The state would have to provide invest a very large portion of its entire capital in this one project without any real assurance that it could pull it off. It was a tremendous technical challenge to build a canal out through wilderness, out into these remote areas. Most people had never been out there. Now, there's a very interesting book that some of you might be interested in that DeWitt Clinton wrote about his trip in 1810. He had gone out there to see, get a sense of the lay of the land, but most people had never been out past the Mohawk Valley. He went all the way out to Buffalo. And he wrote, very erudite man, very interested in birds and various aspects of nature, and he kept notes up and published a memoir of that trip. It was very interesting. New York State Legislature, even though there were still many, many people were saying this would be a foolish waste of money to invest in the canal, the New York State Legislature, which must have moved a lot faster in those days than it does now, a few weeks after the veto of the bill by Madison, they passed funding for the canal, and they broke ground in 4th of July, 1817. So we're coming up to the next year, to the bicentennial, the beginning of the construction of the canal. And to give you just a little perspective on that great building project, it's interesting compared to the Panama Canal, which was built almost 100 years later. And the Panama Canal is considered a tremendous achievement in itself. The Panama Canal is 48 miles long. The Erie Canal is 360 miles. The Panama Canal rises up 85 feet. The Erie Canal rose up more than 600 feet. And of course, the Panama Canal was built at a time when they had steam shovels, railroads, dynamite, whereas the Erie Canal was constructed almost entirely by hand, and that means picks and shovels and wheelbarrows and a lot of Irishmen. So it was a tremendous technical achievement, and given the challenges of it, and a great commercial success, immediately became successful commercially. And one of the great beneficiaries of the canal was New York City. In the early 19th century, the ports of New York were competing, Boston, New York, Baltimore, Philadelphia, Charleston. And the main factor that really determined which port was going to be in the ascendancy was how much of a hinterland it had access to, have easy transportation inland that it could draw resources and send goods up to markets inland. The Middlesex Canal that I mentioned in that little excerpt was an attempt by Boston to extend their hinterlands by connecting to the Merrimack River, which ran up into New Hampshire. Boston had a relatively limited hinterlands. New York was in pretty good shape because it had the Hudson River, but even all the East Coast cities were limited by the wall that was the Appalachian Mountains. New Orleans was the up-and-coming port, and they, of course, had the great potential of the Mississippi River, and that had developed, could have become the great port of New York, of the United States. But the building of the canal extended the hinterlands of New York City all the way up into the Great Lakes and then out into as far as what's now Chicago. That would all became economical to ship things down and to ship manufactured products up. So New York became the depot for the products like lumber and many agricultural products, flour from Rochester. Rochester became the biggest flour milling city in the world. Hay, which you don't usually think of, but there were so many horses that everything ran on horses. To be able to economically bring hay down by water was a great boon. And it vastly increased New York's manufacturing market for manufactured goods. And New York became a stopover for immigrants mostly from Northern Europe that were coming over at that time, who wanted to go up and reach the cheap land out west. They would come to New York and go up the river and then up the canal. It also made New York the financial center, which of course remains today. Because of the Erie Canal was a huge project then. It was all financed through the beginnings of Wall Street. So it's not really an exaggeration to say that the Erie Canal made New York as Jesse Hawley had predicted. And I want to mention just two other effects that the canal had on American history, somewhat contradictory effects. The first one was that it tied the country together. In 1803, we made the purchase of the Louisiana Purchase of all the land going all the way out to Montana. And there were many people who thought the United States was not going to cohere. There was no reason that the people out there, it took 6 weeks of hard travel under best conditions just to get out to Illinois. And why should they have anything really to do with the East Coast, and they envisioned the idea that a canal would tie the country together, which it did, and really united the United States, because it made the travel out there so much more inexpensive. And as I also mentioned that excerpt, they were beginning to develop steamboats, so once you get to Lake Erie, you can take a steamboat the rest of the way. The other effect that you might not think of the Erie Canal is that the people who went out to the west, the travel up the Hudson River and down the Erie Canal, out through the Finger Lake, out through the Great Lakes, were mostly from New England, Mid-Atlantic states, and these immigrants that were coming over. They either had no interest in slavery or they were actively opposed to slavery. And they, by settling the upper Midwest, and first Western New York, Ohio, and then Indiana, Michigan, and out farther, they blocked Southerners from coming up the Mississippi River and settling it. In other words, Southerners were already starting to move into Southern Indiana, Southern Ohio. But in a very few years, the orientation of the country changed from the settled east and the frontier west, and people began to think and talk about the country in terms of the free north and the slave south. And that essentially put us on the path towards the great tragedy of the Civil War. Now, I talked about a number of political and religious enthusiasms in the book that broke out along the Erie Canal. And I think the one thing one theme that sort of united them was the idea of youth. It was really a youth movement. And we imagine those people in the early decades of the 1800s with the mutton chop whiskers and the frock coats and bonnet, and think of them kind of as old people. The people that went to Western New York, people that settled along the canal, were young people. When the canal reached Rochester, which had just a tiny little settlement, that town grew so fast they had invented a new term for it. They called it a boom town. And Rochester was the first boom town. And when it was booming, three quarters of the people who lived there were under 30. So it was really a youth movement that had that youthful energy to it. And I think it's sort of instructive compared to the 1960s in America, when youth was also a prominent feature in American culture, because the people in the 1820s had their communes, and they had their cults, and they had their student uprisings, and they had their strange ideas. And their drug was not LSD or marijuana, but raw whiskey. And America was really at the peak of the greatest drinking binge in its history at that time. And the men who dug the Erie Canal were famous for drinking as they worked. Contractors would agree to give them a pint or a quart a day, whatever it was, and so that they wouldn't have to slow down the work. They had boys that ran along the line of work with dippers and handed them their whiskey. Somebody asked, well, how are they able to dig this straight? And somebody else said, well, who would do that kind of work if they weren't drunk? So, but it's a reality that it was not really unusual. The drinking at work was the boss was generally expected to provide drink, and the guys would take, instead of a coffee break, they'd take a glass of ale or a glass of whiskey. And it was not uncommon to have a big glass of whiskey every day for breakfast. So when we talk about this visionary period in time, it is a reality that a lot of people were walking around with a buzz in it. And I want to go back to those churches I mentioned earlier, which you see all over upstate New York. Every little hamlet will have not just one or two churches, but maybe half a dozen churches, all different denominations. And one of the manifestations of this youthful enthusiasm was was related to religion. The Constitution, of course, had guaranteed the freedom of religion, but it also had said that Congress make no law respecting the establishment of religion. And in those days, people understood that to mean taking taxpayer money and paying the clergy, paying for upkeep of churches. The clergy thought this was going to be a disaster for religion, and it turned out it was a great opportunity. With no official church, and the states gradually got, the Constitution did not prevent the states from establishing churches, but the states followed it along, and they, one by one, they gradually got rid of their established churches. So every denomination had to compete for members, and it injected a great energy into religion, and there was a tremendous resurgence, particularly on the frontier. And you have to remember that like Buffalo was the Wild West at that time. And of all these religious innovators that became influential in those days, many of them were just moved entirely away from Orthodox beliefs altogether and invented their own religions. They were kind of do-it-yourself faiths. And one of the early groups that was followed that course, which you might not think of, was the Shakers. The Shakers had originated just north of Albany, and they moved, they had settlements down along the length of the canal and out into Ohio as well. Today we think of the Shakers as mainly they designed elegant furniture, and they were celibate. Most people know they were celibate. In their own time, they were one of the most radical groups in America. On Sunday nights, they would get together and have these ritual dances. They would sing, go into trances, begin to tremble, and then they start shaking all over, and hence the name. And they turned entirely away from the world. They didn't have a Shaker church in every town. They had these settlements where they would all gather together, self-contained, self-sufficient settlements. They also turned their backs on the great upsurge in the market economy that was happening and was being accelerated by the Erie Canal. The interest of getting rich, the interest of money, they turned away from that. And they were communists. They were they held all their property in common. As one visitor said, what they did about their toothbrushes, I didn't presume to ask. But they were cited by Frederick Engels in 1845 as the first people that really had a practical, established working communist community. And he held them up as a model of what communism could be. 3 years later, Chris wrote the Communist Manifesto with Karl Marx. But Engels totally ignored the fact that they were religious. And that's, of course, their religion was the core of their whole program. And he said, oh, they're religious, that was just humbug. So he didn't quite get the point of the whole thing. But another group that was up along the canal was led by a man named William Miller. And Miller had been originally a farmer. And he was a skeptic. He didn't really believe in religion, but he, for some questioning period in his life, he decided to read the Bible without any commentary. So he began to go through the Bible reading it, just what does it mean? And he found that it meant that the world was going to end. And he proved it mathematically, and he had about five different formulas taken from different books of the Bible, that if you added these numbers together and multiplied and divided, it came up with the world was about to end. And it was, since it was mathematical, it was a little hard to deny that it was true. He started promoting the idea. He got a huge circus tent. They went up and down the Erie Canal with his tent, and his movement grew. They started newspapers, and tens of thousands and then hundreds of thousands of people believed that he had stumbled on something that was true, that was literally true. The idea that the world was about to end was very popular in the early part of the 19th century. There were many groups that believed in the millennium or the apocalypse, and they would argue back and forth, but not many of them set a specific date. And unfortunately for William Miller, he decided, he pointed to a date, which was October 22nd, 1844, and that was going to be the end. And the fire would rain down, the people who were saved would fly into the air, Christ would come in all his glory, and that would be the end. That would be it. So it was interesting for me to imagine the, and these people were very sincere people. There was no question they believed was literally true. And to imagine their frame of mind as the sun went down for the last time ever, October 22nd, and they sat there and waited at midnight, it was going to be the end of time, and eternity would begin. So what was going through their minds is sort of an interesting question. We think that New Year's Eve is a big deal. All the towns along the Erie Canal, many of them had the environment of a port city or port town, and many were actually named for ports. There's Lockport, Rockport, Fairport, Weedsport, Gasport, all little towns along the canal. And they, like any port town or port city, they had a lot of prostitution, drinking, fighting, petty crime, and quite a population of transients moving in and out. And the worst of them all was Rochester. Rochester had a great reputation for being a very rowdy town. So the respectable people of Rochester in the late 1820s, only a few years after the canal opened, decided that they had to do something about it, and they got up a revival of religion. And they invited the greatest preacher of the day was a man named Charles Grandison Finney. And he was the Billy Graham of that era, only more so. He actually invented most of the techniques that Billy Graham and many other revival preachers used over the years. And he came to Rochester, and for 6 months during the winter, they would close the canal down during the winter so that people had time on their hands. He preached almost every night, and during the day he would go door to door and try to convince people to convert, to accept the message that he was pushing. And he would target people who were wealthier or influential in town. If he could get them to convert, he had the idea he would make religion fashionable. Mm-hmm. And that proved to be the case. He was a very effective preacher. And both in Rochester in 1830 and then along the Erie Canal, he had preached all up and down the Erie Canal. This revival began to take, pick up steam. And thousands of people converted, and that was considered the biggest revival, the biggest return to religion in American history. He came to New York, Finney preached in, they built a special temple for him, or what they call a tabernacle, the Broadway Tabernacle. It was about four blocks north of City Hall, and he preached there for a number of years. And he brought a different temperament to American religion. It was finally putting aside the old Puritan, Calvinist, dour sort of religion, and also getting away from the idea that preachers and ministers had to be erudite and very highly educated men. Finney was a very intelligent man, but he started his life as a lawyer, and he used to preach like a lawyer. He would argue you into salvation. But he was not, he hadn't gone through the many years of becoming a doctor of divinity. And he thought that evangelical Christianity should be more hopeful and more accessible to people. And in certain ways, we're living in the afterglow of his revival. Today, there's still 1 in 4 people in America are evangelical, identified as evangelical Christians. And he was really source of much of how that type of evangelical faith was shaped. The greatest of all the do-it-yourself religion promoters was a farm laborer who lived on the Erie Canal. His name was Joseph Smith, and his family had come down from Vermont and settled in the town of Palmyra. They were a hard luck family. They were never could sort of catch on. There was a lot of prosperity along the canal, but it was a very treacherous for people. It was just as easy to lose money as it was to make money on the canal. And his family always seemed to be the losing side. And when he was 22, Smith had a vision of these golden plates that were buried on a hill near his home. He dug them up, translated the characters that were on them into the Book of Mormon. And it was an American scripture. It was told how America had been populated, the North American continent. It described America's role and the various heavenly events that were unfolding. And he held that the Garden of Eden had been in Missouri. So I guess it had to be somewhere with that 49. And whether you consider that a book of imagination, a great work of imagination, whether you think it's a great work of inspiration, or whether, as he said, it was a work of revelation, it was all revealed to him. In fact, as he began to translate the book, after a while he didn't even need to look at the golden plates. He would just, the words would come to him, and he dictated the whole thing to a secretary. But whatever way you look at it, it was an incredible achievement. It was a book of 600 pages by a relatively uneducated young man. 300 named characters, complex stories, flashbacks within flashbacks, prophecies. And he wrote almost the entire thing in 4 months. And as a writer, I can say that's a very intimidating productivity. And plus, he sold millions of copies, so it's also and he didn't stop there. He developed a church around the book, around the prophecies and the story that was told in the book on the Erie Canal. They quite quickly began to move west. Sort of like the Shakers, Joseph Smith had the idea of a community of believers. Everyone would gather in one place. It wasn't going to be just a Mormon church in every town. All the believers should gather together. They went to Ohio, and then they moved farther westward. And he continued to have revelations, and he continued to kind of spin farther from what was the orthodox beliefs of the time. He believed that he read in the Bible where Solomon had 700 wives. Now, he also had 300 concubines, so I don't know what that was about. And Smith decided polygamy as part of his mix, what he called plural marriage. And I won't go into all the details, but that proved to be his downfall, the inclusion of polygamy. And he was murdered in 1844. And he was only 39 years old when he was murdered. He had only been 14 years from the time he found the golden plates. In that time, he had not only translated this tremendous work of imagination, he had formed all the structures of the church, and they were very complex, a priesthood and various different priesthoods, and also secular authorities to rule the town where they were all going to gather together. And it was a work of great imagination and achievement. It's pretty much undeniable. Joseph Smith, of course, never made it to Utah. That was left to Brigham Young. Brigham Young had also lived on the Erie Canal, settled in just outside of Rochester. And today, and it was Brigham Young, of course, that led the Mormons out to a great trek out to Utah. Today, there's 15 million people that believe in the Mormon religion. So it's and an interesting thing about the Book of Mormon is, in researching my own book, was how much scholarly attention has been given to that book over the almost 200 years since it was written. I mean, it's quite amazing. Every detail has been looked at by both Mormon scholars and other non-Mormon scholars. So to be the creation of a young farm laborer, it was quite a remarkable work of just of American literature. And I just would note in passing that it's easy to make light of these people. Their beliefs and activities often seem bizarre by our standards. But I actually have a lot of sympathy for Joseph Smith and for Finney and Miller and the others, because I think that they were men and women. There was a number of women, you know, Shakers were led by women. That they were looking for truth, and they had the courage to go beyond the orthodox, beyond the easy, safe beliefs of everybody else, and to try to grope into the dark for their own truth. So I think, though they've been ridiculed, they were ridiculed in their own time, and they've been ridiculed plenty since, I think we can profit from looking at them and sort of taking seriously what they said. As I mentioned before, the Erie Canal was a tremendous commercial success. It was enlarged and deepened in the early years of the, in the middle part of the 19th century. It actually took them about 30 years to enlarge the canal. The original ditch had only been 4 feet deep, so they wanted to make it bigger. The traffic was so heavy up and down, they wanted to enlarge the locks and so forth. So that was a long project, but it continued to make money throughout the 19th century, even as the railroads came in and competed with the canal, because it was always cheaper, and even today, of course, it always takes less energy to move any bulky product along water rather than any other means. And if you think that Erie Canal is irrelevant, I would just point out that later in its history, the canal took in more in tolls than the entire cost of building, more in tolls in 1 year than the entire cost of building the original Erie Canal. And today we're in a crisis of infrastructure investment. It's kind of a slow moving crisis. You don't hear much about the headlines unless a bridge falls down. But for the first time in our history, our infrastructure, the roads, bridges, waterways, rail lines, electrical grid, are no longer expanding. And in fact, we're not spending enough to maintain them. So every year, the infrastructure on which our economy and on which our standard of living really depends is deteriorating. And why this should be so is a complicated question. Why should it be such a political football, which it has become? And I think one of the answers to the question is, it was always a political football. It was back when they built the Erie Canal. There was arguments back and forth. Is it going to work? Is it not going to work? But somehow they found a way to get over this political hurdle, and they had the gumption and the foresight to invest in the future. So maybe as we come up to the 200th anniversary of the canal, it can serve as a kind of inspiration for today. It's something it's a serious problem that's just becoming worse and worse and worse, and a very costly problem. The Erie Canal continued into the 20th century, but the barges that I saw when I was a kid were really the end of an era. The traffic on the canal gradually began to fall off. And in 1959, they completed the St. Lawrence Seaway, which allowed ocean-going ships, regular full-size ships, to come down into Lake Ontario and then through the Welland Canal of Canada into Lake Erie, and then all the way on out to Chicago. So the era of putting material on barges, which were of course much, much smaller, and taking down the canal really began to pass quite quickly, and business of the Erie Canal then fell off. But in 1900, it was still viable, and the state had to decide whether to enlarge it, modernize it, they made the decision to do so, spent a lot of money. They completely abandoned the eastern end of the canal, and they turned the Mohawk River and Oneida Lake incorporated those into the canal, and the western end they enlarged along the original route. And they called that the Barge Canal. Now, they recently changed it back to the Erie Canal. But changes that they made was that the mules, which had always pulled the barges and the boats along the Erie Canal, were beginning to be phased out anyway. In the new canal, there would be no more mules. Everything would be tugboats or powered barges. And in 1905, a man named Thomas Allen wrote a song that many of us learned in third grade about the canal, and particularly about the mules on the canal, which were then a thing of the past. So his song was really a nostalgic song, looking back on that to a simpler time. And I think it's that simpler time that we all remember from when we were young. And life was different then. And America was different. Because in those days, you always knew your neighbor, and you always knew your pal. And at least you did if you ever navigated on the Erie Canal. Thank you very much. Yeah, the original train that went up there, it was actually in 1831, which was only 6 years after the canal opened. It was like a stagecoach, cars, yeah. And an engine up there. So, but the railroads developed pretty quickly, and many of the other canals that were built, there were a lot of side canals built in New York State and other states, didn't make money because they, partly because of the railroads. One great advantage was that they were, in addition to being cheaper to make, they could be run all year, whereas all canals had to be shut down in the winter. So. Yes, in the back.
Is there any place now, because I've been trying to find out, where one can still ride on the Erie Canal, so where would you pick it up in upstate New York?
Well, yeah, there's plenty of tour books that go, at any length you want to go, practically.
Would you know a particular city?
I think
I'm trying to do research.
Syracuse.
Syracuse, thank you.
Well, Syracuse, maybe. Well, you could probably get us even at Waterford, which is the first town on the Erie Canal north of Albany, I would think. But there's a lot of commercial upstate. It's a big tourist attraction up there now, and there really is. And there's like those river cruises you see in Europe. They have those for the Erie Canal as well.
There's an Erie Canal Museum.
The what?
There's an Erie Canal Museum near Utica that you can ride for half an hour with the mules. But the better things are the exhibits inside that show you a whole lot about.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I know Rochester, in the Rochester area, they have boats. There's one called the Sand Patch, but there's a motorized boat that goes up and down. Yeah.
Did Hawley or Fertility experience any gratification or reward?
Well, that's an interesting question, because for some reason, I never really could figure out why he kept his identity secret until the canal was finished. Now, why he did that, I don't know. But,
and then what happened?
And he complained about it. He was included in some of the celebration, and he complained about he didn't get enough recognition. Now, but why that was, DeWitt Clinton knew he had written those essays in 1807, and a few other people knew, but for some reason he kept his, he was kind of an odd character.
Was he generous? I mean, sounds like.
No. He recognized. Hawley got their credit. Though there was a lot of people that, a great idea. Suddenly you've got 10 people that had first thought of it. So, yes.
Yes, I'm wondering about the Jefferson comment, because when he was in Paris, he wrote Washington that he wanted an Erie Canal in America, and suddenly he turned against it. I mean, you said he.
Well, I think it was two things. Partly it was the technical challenge. They just thought it was technically impossible and it would be a waste of money. And also, he went back and forth about whether the federal government should be involved in these things, or whether it should be private or left to the states.
He thought he was an inventor, so I was wondering why I didn't think it would work.
He eventually ate his words when he ate a very big chunk of pearl pie when it was successful. He only lived for a year after, of course, opened all the way. But the Erie Canal opened in sections, so they knew it was going to be successful long before they got all the way to Buffalo, because you could ride from, say, Utica down to Albany, or you could ride from Syracuse to Albany before the rest of it was finished. Yeah?
I've been doing research on 19th century Utica. I mean, basically every month it seems that there's more online, and you've done an impressive amount of research. Which sources for research have been the most valuable or the most surprising and interesting to you in your process?
In terms of what?
Well, did you spend your time looking at 19th century newspapers?
I did some 19th century newspapers. I used a lot of secondary sources. As far as the canal itself, there's a wealth of material that I didn't go into it all, but there's a big museum in Syracuse that's got a lot of material there. I was a little bit more interested in the aftermath of what after the canal was built. But interesting thing about Utica was that the canal went right through the middle of Utica. Rome, which was where they had this great enthusiasm for the canal, but because this town of Rome was a little bit higher, the canal went a mile south, and that was the death of Rome. And Rome never thrived. And when the canal opened, they had a procession of people in mourning, because Utica was doing so well, and it's only not that far down the line. But the cities that were right on the canal were the ones that really thrived. And Syracuse was, Rochester, canal or right through the downtown. When they built the Barge Canal, a lot of those, they rerouted in Syracuse and Rochester, they routed it south into more of the suburbs. Yeah.
Clinton is the same man who developed the grid in Manhattan. Thurber Clinton. Is he the same person that developed the grid in Manhattan?
Thurber Clinton, I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
I'd like to give you a definitive answer, but I'm not sure yet.
I wonder if I can comment on this.
Robert Albion, in his book, Rise of New York Port, maintains that New York City was the leading American port by 1850 before construction even started in the area.
Well, it was certainly the as far as population, as far as the traffic, that's absolutely true. But the fact that the if you look at the population rise, I mean, at between 1820 and 1830 or 1830 and 1840, New York expanded tremendously. But I don't deny that was, and New Orleans got a little late start because that didn't actually become part of the United States until 1803. But I think the Hudson River itself really gave New York a good start. Yeah.
Is there a connection, and what is the connection between the New York State Barge Canal, basically in Niskayuna, New York, where that runs?
Right.
And before that, I lived in Pittsburgh, where the Erie Canal was. So is there a connection between these two canals?
In Pittsburgh?
No, in Pittsburgh, New York.
Pittsburgh up by Rochester.
Yeah.
Well, the original Erie Canal and the enlarged canal both ran south of the Mohawk River. They started at the Hudson and went up, and you can see a lot of the old locks from the enlarged canal are still there on the south side of the Mohawk River. The barge canal began on the north side of the Mohawk River and went up, and once it got past the hose where the falls is, now joined into the Mohawk River itself. And whereas the original canal kept to the south, it crossed over a couple of times back and forth, but was a completely separate waterway. Once you get out west, then it's all the same. But Pittsburgh is the original path of the Erie Canal. That's where it originally went.
Do you do any work on the subscriptions of New Yorkers who are involved in backing the enterprise? And I don't really know much about that. I just know that there were a number of subscriptions.
Yeah, there was, I didn't really get into that because of the construction of the canal, the politics of the canal have been covered pretty good. Pretty well in my other books. So there's some very good books on Bond of the Union being one of them. It's an excellent book on just how the canal developed and all the politics that surrounded it. I didn't want to get into that, so I didn't really go into that research in that particular subject. Yeah.
You mentioned the tourism on the canal today. Is there a significant economic activity of transfer of goods on the canal today?
You mean commercial?
Yeah.
No, there's very little. General Electric does ship some like the parts for big wind turbines up there on barges, but it's just it's not cost effective to load onto a barge, take it up wherever it's going, and then take it off onto a ship. That's now it's all on, you could have a ship that would hold probably 20 barge. So 20 barges could come right down the St. Lawrence River, and it's just an awful lot cheaper. So there's not really much commercial traffic at all. It's all pleasure boats. Yeah.
There are American cultural historians who like to look at the Mormons and connect it to a lot of what you've said, the number of immigrants that were coming, not only to build the canal, but to live. You know, that's a good way to get there. Cultures mixing. Religions mixing in the burned out region, and a lot of Elmer Gantry characters. They even say, they have Italian diet reform that you see, Do you agree with them that all of this is the mix that produced Joseph Smith?
Well, I think he was, I don't use the term burned over district, though a lot of the subjects that I talk about were referred to as in the, there was a book that came out in the 40s, it was called The Burned Over District, and it was a very interesting pulling together of all those things as a kind of sociological study. I don't like the term burned over district because it's a confusing term, I find, because what he's thought sort of meant was it was spiritually dead. That's what burned over district meant. Most people take it to mean it was burning with spiritual energy, which that area was. So what did the term mean? It was a little, it was confusing, so I never used that term. And I don't think that, I think that the different movements have their distinct identities. That was not, it wasn't just a kind of all together, but they certainly influenced each other. And you can see, particularly Joseph Smith, he was like a sponge for everything that was going on. There was Shakers, the different the anti-Masons, which I talk about in the book, I didn't go into it tonight. He had aspects of that in his whole thinking of it. So there was a lot of interaction, but I think it's more interesting to look at each one separately than to sort of try to group them together and say, what's the common thread? Yes?
What's not in the book that you considered including? The book is fascinating. I found it fascinating because it's a wonderful story of the canal. You know what? It's also a wonderful story of the canal and the Mormons and religious changes and Masons and what didn't you? What's left out?
I consider putting the Oneida community in because they have a very interesting history as well. But I had to stop somewhere, and I pretty much cut it off in 1844. The Oneida community came on later. Spiritualists, all those movements were talked about in that Burned Over District. I think it was pure coincidence that the Fox sisters that began the spiritualist movement lived about 4 miles from Joseph Smith's house. But I think it was purely coincidence that he was gone from there before they were even born. So you want to take one more question? Any last question? Yes.
Wasn't that a center of abolitionism?
Yes, and a lot of that, and I didn't go into it in detail, but Finney was had an acolyte named Theodore Dwight Weld, and Weld was one of the early real proponents of fanatical abolitionism. And many of those people, those revivals had a moral aspect as well as just religion. Finney preached, you can't just convert and become a holy person. You have to go out and save the world. And abolition was one of their big causes. Abolition was absolutely hated, even in New York, of course, New York City and New York, upstate New York. You think, oh, they were receptive of it. They weren't. They hated abolition.